Reitmeier.
May it please the Court. My name is Emily Reitmeier, and I represent the appellant, Mr. Parnell Gully. Mr. Gully is appealing his conviction because the government introduced a multitude of evidence constituting other bad acts in violation of Federal Rule of Evidence 404B. Mr. Gully is also appealing his sentence because the District Court, pursuant to now overruled Seventh Circuit precedent, did not apply the Fair Sentencing Act. This case should be remanded for a new trial, or at a minimum, remanded for resentencing under the Fair Sentencing Act. I'm going to focus on three main points today. First, the litany of evidence introduced at trial unrelated to the events of October 21, 2008 is not admissible under 404B. Second,
Nothing is admissible under Rule 404B. It's a rule of exclusion. It's admissible or not under Rule 402.
Correct. Correct, Your Honor. Thank you. Second, Mr. Gully properly preserved his 404B issue for appeal. And third, the government's argument of harmless error related to Mr. Gully's sentencing fails upon examination of the record. With regard to Rule 404B, in this trial, there was not just one errant reference to Mr. Gully's past acts. The government presented evidence that Mr. Gully often drove Mr. Blake around, sometimes taking Mr. Blake to buy or sell crack cocaine. The government presented evidence that police found ecstasy at a firearm during a search of another one of Mr. Blake's apartments, even though Mr. Gully was not present at that apartment when the search took place. The government presented evidence that Mr. Gully was on parole at the time of the alleged crime. And the government presented extensive evidence of a separate drug transaction with Mr. Blake, not Mr. Gully, on October 23rd, 2008, for which the CI could not identify Mr. Gully as the driver.
Now, Rule 404B says that evidence that also shows other crimes may be used to show knowledge. And if I understand this case correctly, Mr. Gully said he had no idea that the substance he was furnishing to customers was an illegal drug. Now, why can't you use other evidence to show that he had more knowledge than he was willing to let on?
We're not saying that 404B evidence cannot be used to show knowledge. I think the issue here is that Mr. Gully did not put his knowledge at issue in the second trial. In Mr. Gully's opening statement, his trial counsel simply stated, after you hear all of the evidence in this case in this matter, you will not be convinced beyond a reasonable doubt that there's been any showing of a knowing and intelligent voluntary distribution of cocaine by Mr. Gully on the date in question. Now, that's not putting a state of mind at issue. That's simply stating that the government isn't going to meet their burden of satisfying the elements that it must show to prove the offense.
And one would therefore think, actually, that state of mind is at issue unless the defendant was willing to agree with the prosecutor on a stipulation about state of mind or state of knowledge.
In specific intent cases, the evidence about knowledge can come in because knowledge is always deemed at issue. Now, this was a case of distribution, which is not considered a specific intent case. It's considered a general intent case, in which case the defendant has to put his own state of mind at issue before this other evidence can come in. We're not saying the government cannot prove intent. It necessarily has to prove intent, but it cannot do it using evidence of other bad acts.
So was the nature of the defense that there was no drug transaction at all that was depicted on the tape and described by the cooperating source?
The nature of the defense. So the defense didn't put on any witnesses, and the nature of the defense was essentially that the government failed to meet its burden, that it failed to show that Mr. Gully was on the tape distributing the drugs on that date.
So it was a combination ID, and it wasn't a drug transaction case?
I think that would be a fair characterization.
Okay. Then to the extent that the evidence has something to do with identity and opportunity, apart from knowledge, isn't it admissible on those grounds?
I think you also have to look at not just that the evidence goes to some issue in the case. I think you have to look at the full four-part test for the 404B evidence. And I think when you look at the prejudice that this evidence had, essentially the evidence came in saying he's done a prior drug deal. He hangs out with people who do drug deals that have guns and other drugs in their house. Ergo, he must have done this drug deal. And there's a way to get that evidence in without providing the prejudice that happened in this case. I think I'd also like to point out that, you know, any statement that Mr. Gulley made to the police prior to the trial does not necessarily put a state of mind at issue if that statement is not introduced by Mr. Gulley. And even if Mr. Gulley might have put a state of mind at issue in the first trial, that does not mean the government can just introduce this evidence in the second trial as kind of a preemptive way to deal with a possible defense that comes up. Now, if he clearly would have indicated, I am presenting this defense of intent, then the government could introduce it, and there's case law that supports that. But Mr. Gulley never indicated in the second trial that he was going to present such a defense.
Well, if it's the defense that's in the nature of I'm putting you to your burden of proof, then the government can kind of go whole hog, can't it?
I think that's the issue, is that there has to be some limit. And just because you say, you know, I'm denying the elements of the crime, and essentially you don't...
Rule 403, not Rule 404.
Correct.
402 says relevant evidence comes in, and this is relevant evidence. Rule 404B says we don't keep something out when it can be used to show knowledge. And then your final string is Rule 403, which says that if they're gilding the lily and if it's too prejudicial for its legitimate use, then keep it out. But was there a Rule 403 objection made at trial? Actually, there's no Rule 404 objection made either. But
correct. Our position
is that there was no Rule 403 objection made.
Correct. Our position is that the...
It's often hard to blame the district court for an improper balancing under Rule 403 when he was never asked to balance under Rule 403.
Correct. And our position is that the motion in limine filed prior to trial would preserve both the 404B and the 403 argument for appeal and essentially alerted the government...
There was no 403 or 404B argument made before trial.
No, there was
the motion in limine made before trial was completely absurd, right? It said no evidence of anything other than the day, one day.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there's no such rule, right? You want to make a 403 or 404 motion, you have to make it.
I think in hindsight, a better way would be to specifically make that motion. But our position is that the reference to not allowing evidence I'm trying to find the language here.
Was there a bad axe reference in there somewhere?
Yeah, that's what I'm trying to figure out. He uses the phrase
I mean, that's sort of code.
Other bad conduct,
yeah, that's
is
sort
the
of
phrase that he uses.
Code for 404B.
That's our position, that essentially without specifically invoking it, that other bad conduct is close enough to the 404 other crimes, wrongs, or acts, and that preserves the issue. But again, in hindsight's 20/20, and again in hindsight, it might have been better to specifically reference 404B or 403.
Well, technically, too. I mean, if the government has true 404B evidence, they're supposed to put the defense on notice, right?
Correct.
It begs the question about what's 404B.
Our argument is still that it put everyone on issue that this was evidence that would fall under those rules. I would like to turn briefly to sentencing. I see I've entered my rebuttal time, but I'll get this in quickly. The only issue that comes down to sentencing is essentially the effect of the error. We all agree that there's an error, that he wasn't sentenced under the Fair Sentencing Act, which was the law at the time. The government argues that the error is harmless. We argue that the error is not harmless and justifies a resentencing. I think the most interesting point is that the court mentions twice that the Supreme Court is considering this issue and that Mr. Gulley, quote, may get relief. And it's very interesting that he would make this statement if he would have sentenced Mr. Gulley to the same sentence had the Fair Sentencing Act applied.
Well, the judge actually went beyond that and repeatedly invited an appeal on this issue.
He did. And I think that's where we fall out, is there are some statements that can be read one way, there's some statements that can be read the other, but you can't take it in isolation. And looking at the record as a whole, I think a brief resentencing proceeding is not that big of a burden. I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for appeal.
My counsel. Mr. Hartzler.
They only set you up for long terms. Saves the government a lot of money.
Yeah.
Travel expense. And
always glad to see you, so it's nice to have you.
The feeling is mutual. Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you. Let me start with the sentencing issue, because I think it raises an interesting question of whether or not there can be harmless error when the judge imposes a sentence that the parties in the court agree is substantively reasonable, and the sentence is within the guideline range that would apply if the error hadn't occurred. That's what we have here, and I don't think that has occurred in some of the other cases. I think Anderson is the closest case where this court found there to be harmless error.
I think the problem here is that the judge was kind of all over the map on why he was giving a downward variance. At times it seemed like it was based on the crack powder disparity, and at times it seemed like it was because he wanted to vary from the career offender status of the defendant, and he didn't think he was a big-time career offender, and there's all kinds of statements in the record to that effect. So, you know, it's hard to discern whether the judge was doing this variance in recognition of the Fair Sentencing Act claim that he was inviting the defendant to take an appeal on to preserve it for future review, or whether he was inviting or whether he was varying because he wanted to do so because he thought the career offender guideline was overly harsh in the circumstances, and that's the difficulty I see with this transcript.
The guideline for the career offender is overly harsh on two grounds. Either because of the criminal history that's automatic under the career offender, or because of the disparity between crack and powder cocaine.
Right.
And the judge was perfectly clear, and I think we all understand, that Mr. Gulley's criminal history points were high enough that he was going to rank in Category 6 regardless of the career offender. So whether or not he was a big-time dealer, what are his circumstances, the issue is, well, what's the other factor then? And it's only the disparity between crack and powder. The judge says, so I believe the proper variance from 360 to life for the crack cocaine disparity is 262 to 327 months. And that is the range that would apply if the judge had applied the Fair Sentencing Act. So this is a defendant, I mean, it's an unusual circumstance, I grant that. And the problem, of course, is the judge didn't say, I will impose this sentence even if the Fair Sentencing Act applies. By the way, with respect to you may get relief, I hope you do, that sort of thing, that's all said a little bit before he does the variance. He's not really talking about a variance. He's talking about that he hopes that the Supreme Court will, you know, with all due respect, reverse this court on Dorsey. But that comes on early. He hopes that he hopes this defendant, all defendants, get relief from the Supreme Court, as we all know happened. But I don't read it to be, I agree that he's varying from the career offender guideline, but he's varying because of the disparity between crack and powder cocaine, I believe. That doesn't satisfy your...
Well, he's saying, you know, any of the findings that this case is not under the Fair Sentencing Act... I accurately stated the advisory guidelines, everybody agrees. But then he immediately follows up and says that I hope it doesn't apply to you.
I hope it doesn't.
I hope it doesn't apply to you because I hope, you know, the decision of this court gets reversed. And then I come back to the statements about the career offender status. I understand that the application of the career offender guideline, you know, he was going to get those criminal history points no matter what.
Right.
But the judge did say that he didn't view him as a big-time criminal offender based on the nature of his priors. And from that, it's a little hard to discern whether the downward variance was limited to recognizing the crack powder disparity. And if it was, maybe there was harmless error. Or whether he wanted to give him a break on more than one ground.
I understand.
That's the ambiguity I see.
I understand.
Okay.
And we're agreeing that the case needs to go back for resentencing on the supervised release, so we might get clarity if the court is so inclined. I think you probably know that our office had a tremendous number of these post-Dorsey cases in which we agreed to a remand. I think this is the only one other than the Hibble case where there was a waiver that this court affirmed. Other than that, we've always agreed with the remand. This is a case that breaks that mold, where it looks as though the judge varied downward to reach the Fair Sentencing Act guideline range and imposed perfectly reasonable, no one's disputing the reasonableness of this sentence, and imposed a reasonable sentence within the guideline range that applies. So, you know, how could that be anything other than harmless? And the argument is, well, he would have varied even more. Well, he could have varied even more. He didn't. He reached a guideline range that he thought was reasonable under the circumstance. It happens to coincide with the guideline range that applies under the Fair Sentencing Act. That seems pretty harmless. On the 404B argument, it sounds as though there's an understanding of the circumstances. I agree that prior to the first trial, the defendant did say in a unbelievably cursory fashion that wanted to exclude any bad conduct evidence from any day other than that particular day. And, of course, the problem with that is the argument now is that would exclude even the confession, even the admissions that the defendant made post-arrest and after he reached a cooperation agreement, because that's really the most damaging evidence that came in. And I think also why it makes this evidence so, or that the government's proof in this case so overwhelming. I mean, the defendant's statement really just buried him. And the evidence in the case, that's both the post-arrest statement and certainly this statement that came in appropriately after he began to cooperate and essentially confessed to the crime.
Right, right. I don't think anybody argues about that. But I don't think statements are immune from 404B limitations. Confessions can be subject to that rule as well. So if the defendant confessed to a murder or something, you can't get that in. But
or let's say he confessed to being on parole. How about that? There's a good example, right? Yeah, no, there's no disagreement that just because the defendant makes a statement doesn't mean it's admissible. Yeah, the problem here is that the defense was, one, it wasn't even, the government had failed to prove that Gully was the guy that came to the car and distributed the drugs. I mean, that's what he says in closing argument. He argues that the evidence failed to prove that that Gully was even present in Mr. Hurd's car.
Right.
And then secondly,
that's owing to the quality of the tape, right? But you had the confidential witness's testimony as well, right?
I'm not saying it's a winning argument. That was the argument.
Right.
Yeah. No, it was obviously not a winning argument. Yeah. No, he's arguing that there's insufficient evidence to prove that Mr. Gully was the one that came to the car that distributed the drugs. That's his first argument. And secondly, he argues that even if it was him, he didn't hand something. He may have handed something over without paying attention to it. And that's not a knowing violation of the law. So I don't think it's reasonable to say that the defendant's knowledge was not put at issue in this case. And that's why the evidence came in. So back to your question or your remarks about the statement, there's no question about it. Just because a defendant confesses to, you know, killing President Kennedy, that doesn't come into the case unless it's relevant. Well, clearly it's relevant here because the defendant's knowledge of what he was distributing on October 21st was the main issue in this case, in addition to the question of whether or not it was him. Both issues were raised by the defendant. His statements disprove those claims, that defense. Thank you again.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. Anything further, counsel?
I'd just like to make a couple additional points on the sentencing argument. First, that the burden isn't to show that the sentence is reasonable. The burden is to show that the sentence would be the same if the error did not occur. And we maintain that the government falls short of those assurances. And I would direct you to our briefs where we collect cases in which case such assurances are made and this court felt comfortable finding harmless error. The second thing I would like to point out is in the Riles case, R-Y-A-L-S, which is citing in the government's brief, the case was remanded for resentencing on the supervised release term, and the court invited the district court at that point, since it already was being resentenced, to consider whether it would sentence the same under the Fair Sentencing Act for the entire term of imprisonment. And I think that's instructive here. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. Counsel, we appreciate your willingness to accept the appointment in this case and your assistance to the court as well as your client. The case is taken under advisement, and the court will be in recess.